actually changed the title of the paper to Truth, Risk and Trust in Rodrigo Reyrosa's Human Material. This book, which came out in 2009, presents itself as the debris of a failed attempt to novelise Guatemala's National Police Archive and the project for its recovery. What I'd like to argue in this paper is that if we take the text at its apparent word, we'll miss a series of opportunities to make sense both of the book and of the post-peace Guatemala that it portrays. To use those opportunities, we need to read Human Material as fiction, not fiction as make-believe, but fiction as a genre that rewards a particular kind of attention, in which invented elements are standard but not essential. The attractions of the project and the archive for a novelist are evident. First, there's the manner in which the largest collection of secret state documents in Latin American history was discovered by accident in 2005, when investigators from the Human Rights Ombudsman's Office were sent to verify that the National Civil Police had removed explosives from their storage facility next to a military base in Guatemala City, where 3 weeks earlier more than a ton of projectiles left over from the war had detonated, destroying homes in the neighbourhood. In one of the police buildings, the investigators found great stacks of paper, which were an obvious fire hazard. When they asked the senior police officer on the site what these papers were, she said, "This is the archive of the National Police." The archive that, according to President Alvaro Arzu and his administration during the peace process in the mid-1990s, had been lost. It contains more than 80 million documents, some of them dating back to the 1890s. I've just given you the address of a photo essay by the photographer James Rodriguez, which has some terrific photos in it, but I'll just move on to one that I could actually put into a PowerPoint presentation to give you an idea of what the papers were like when they found them. Then there's the way in which this extraordinary cache was preserved by a team of archivists who secured international funding and began the immense slow labour of cleaning, repairing, classifying and scanning the documents, in spite of Molotov cocktail attacks and other forms of intimidation. At one point, nature seemed to conspire with the social forces ranged against the project. A huge sinkhole opened up next to the archive and threatened to swallow it. But in spite of geophysical hazards and political turbulence, the project has survived and grown. The historian Kirsten Weld gives a fascinating insider's account of its workings in her recent book, Paper Cadavers. As a subject for fiction, the archive came with narrative tension built in, so to speak, since it promised to yield evidence incriminating the perpetrators and intellectual authors of Guatemala's counterinsurgency operations in the years from 1960 to 1996, which led to approximately 150,000 executions and 45,000 disappearances. The physical setting may also have appealed to Reyrosa's dystopic imagination. The complex of La Isla, which houses the archive, includes the police academy, a criminal investigations bureau, the police dog kennels, and an abandoned hospital, a munitions depot, and a huge accumulation of car wrecks, which you can see if you go to the photo essay that I put up the address for before. If, as Edelbert Avalar argues in The Untimely Present, post-dictatorial literature depicts the urban space as an allegorical ruin, La Isla is a ready-made. At the end of his introduction, Reyrosa writes, "Apart from the information that I hope to discover in that labyrinth of millions of police files accumulated over more than a century and preserved by chance, the circumstances and the ambience of the archive at La Isla had begun, in the wake of that initial visit, to seem novel-like and maybe even novelizable, a kind of micro-chaos, an account of which could serve as a coda to the singular danse macabre of our last century. The chaos of the papers and of the complex in which they are housed mirrors in miniature the chaos of a nation swept up in a dance of death." What Reyrosa does not say here is that he had in fact already novelised the archive in his 2001 novel Piedras Encantadas, Magic Stones, locating it speculatively in the basement of the Gran Palacio Nacional, at the heart of the heart of our bloody democracy. When the discovery was made at La Isla in 2005, he may well have been curious to see how verisimilar his imagination had been. In spite of these attractions, Reyrosa's projected novelisation fails, or seems to, for a series of reasons that come to light progressively. At first, he hopes to investigate the cases of intellectuals and artists who'd been under police surveillance or had collaborated with the police as informers in the course of the 20th century. but he has to give up this hope immediately, given the chaotic state of the material. It will take 15 years to classify the documents, says the chief, as he is known throughout the book. In Magic Stones, Ray Rosa had imagined an official nicknamed the Shadow descending into the basement of the Gran Palacio Nacional and returning with a file before the expected time in exchange for 500 quetzales from a detective. That scenario begins to look like science fiction or allegory or both when the neglect of the real archive is revealed. A corner of the chaos has been fully catalogued, the papers generated by the Identification Bureau. And that's where the chief encourages Ray Rosa to begin, asking him not to consult documents more recent than 1970 for his own personal safety and because they might relate to open legal cases. But soon his access to the archive is suspended altogether, for reasons that the chief promises to explain fully when they meet in person. This meeting, however, is repeatedly postponed, and in fact, we never learn exactly why Ray Rosa was asked not to return. At first, the chief says that it has something to do with the fact that he was shown transcripts of a radio conversation which broke a security protocol. And then in a later meeting, he speaks of misunderstanding, resentment, proper channels, professional jealousy, and security issues. Near the end of the book, one of the project workers tells Ray Rosa that the chief has sweetened the pill, but the only clarification provided is that these things are decided among the leaders. This vagueness may conceal a more specific reason. One of Ray Rosa's friends, who is a member of a guerrilla organization, informs him of a rumor going around at La Isla, according to which the novelist's reason for visiting the archive was to find the people who had kidnapped his mother in 1981 and who might be among the project's employees. Ray Rosa's mother was held for 6 months and ransomed by the family, who made no attempt to have the crime investigated, largely because they believed at the time that it had been committed by corrupt government officials or by members of the police force. Such cases were not uncommon. It was not until 1994 that an alternative scenario emerged. A new friend, who'd been a guerrilla fighter, told Ray Rosa that the kidnappers had belonged to a short-lived, little-known group of urban insurgents. This news came as an unpleasant shock to someone whose sympathies lay, and still lie, with the revolutionary organisations. Unable to resume his visits to the archive, Ray Rosa begins to feel that he is the subject of an intimidation campaign. He receives numerous silent phone calls late at night, a message from a company offering a home funeral service, and an anonymous warning not to stir up the ant's nest. He suspects that one of the archivists, a certain Roberto Lemus, said to have been a member of the group that kidnapped his mother, is behind all this. But having more or less confirmed this hypothesis, he comes to the anticlimactic conclusion that Lemus is a pathetic figure, unworthy of pursuit. There is no confrontation or resolution of the backstory, and by this stage, Ray Rosa has come to feel that others have better moral or technical qualifications for representing the archive to the outside world. I quote, "It would be more fitting for an ex-combatant or a group of ex-combatants, and not a mere dilettante writing from a very marginal perspective, to be the first to bring to light what remains hidden in that magnificent labyrinth of papers. If I haven't been able to novelise it, as I thought I would be able to, it's for want of luck and strength." Later, he remarks to the cinematographer Guillermo Escalón, who's been asked to participate in the making of a documentary film on La Isla, that cameras will do a better job than writing. So the author's declarations in the body of the text indicate that the project to novelise the project failed, and that human material is a preparatory dossier. This categorisation is favoured by the way in which the book presents itself as an accumulation of jottings, simple impressions and observations, says the author, in a succession of notebooks. These notebooks are described in archival style, in lieu of chapter titles, first notebook, green cover with Indian motifs, etc. The simplicity and dailiness of the impressions and observations creates a strong sense of reality, and I see no good reason to doubt that most of what is written is true. We're not dealing in the main with mere reality effects. Human material can certainly be read as non-fiction or as a pre-fictional pile of raw materials, and it does lead us to the heart of the archive by transcribing a long series of records from the Identification Bureau. But I agree with Yancy Perez that we should not be too quick to accept Ray Rosa's admission of defeat. The book was published, after all, in Anagrama's Hispanic Narrative series and not with their chronicles. It also begins with the following liminary note. Although it may not seem like one, although it's not meant to seem like one, this is a work of fiction. This seems to be in direct contradiction with the passage that I quoted earlier. If I haven't been able to novelise it, it's for want of luck and strength. Unless we read the if as a genuine conditional, as I think we should, not because we should trust the teller rather than the tale, or because this question of classification is important in itself, but because classifying the book as fiction allows it to speak to us more fully about what really does matter. Stacey Friend has argued persuasively that fiction cannot be satisfactorily defined and distinguished from non-fiction in terms of necessary and sufficient conditions. She proposes instead to construe fiction and non-fiction as genre or supergenre, categories whose membership is determined by a cluster of non-essential criteria. Borrowing terms from Kendall Walton's account of perception in a category, she argues that classification as fiction or non-fiction influences the way we experience, understand, and evaluate a work by specifying a contrast class against which the work's properties stand out as being standard, contrastandard, or variable. A standard feature places or tends to place a work in a particular category. A contrastandard feature excludes or tends to exclude a work from the category, and a variable feature can differ between works in a category without bearing on classification. Friend gives, in effect, an incomplete list of standard features for fiction when she says that if we take a text to be fiction, we will expect it to engage us imaginatively through narrative, to deploy certain literary devices, to include invented elements such as descriptions of what has never happened and names that fail to refer, to make claims that are not assertions by the author, and so on. Human material displays at least three of these features. It engages us imaginatively, it employs the device of allegory, and it includes invented names that do not refer but do signify. To begin with imaginative engagement, the book induces an experience of immersion, largely through the slow development of narrative tension. The tension is built by implicitly raising a series of curiosity questions about past and current events in the story. Why was Ray Rosa's access to the archive suspended? Is he being threatened or is he being paranoid? And suspense questions concerning what is yet to occur. Will he be able to return to the archive and what's waiting for him there? Rather than disdaining these mechanisms, as sophisticated critics sometimes do, or regarding them as frivolous, given the book's grave subject matter, I think we would do better to listen to Jean-Marie Schaeffer when he argues that mimetic immersion is fiction's immanent function, on which all its possible transcendent functions, such as entertaining, informing, or influencing opinion, necessarily hinge. As well as pleasure, immersive reading provides special opportunities for sense-making. We tend to assume that details in a work of fiction are functional and significant, rather than mere reflections of the way things were. This is probably why, as Deborah Henderson and Herb Clarke discovered, when asking readers to retell narratives labelled as either fiction or non-fiction, the same text, subjects who think they're reading fiction retell the stories at much greater length with significantly more detail. If reading a text as fiction improves our retention of details, it also allows us to connect them and so to discern significant patterns. Human Material is a text that rewards this recollective kind of reading and rereading precisely because of its artful fragmentariness. For example, a pattern begins to emerge when the author visits the Spanish artist Miquel Barceló in Paris and sees him experimenting with a kind of papier-mâché that he intends to use to decorate the roof of a chamber in the Palace of Nations in Geneva. So this is, that's more of the rotting archives in the archive. Here's the roof of the chamber in the Palace of Nations, which has apparently been a very controversial work. Ray Rosa's first thought is, I could teach my daughter how to do this. Back in Guatemala, he notes, I think of using Barceló blocks to build a refuge labyrinth that could also serve as an allegory. Instead of throwing out the newspapers that he has been using that he's been reading to catch up on what happened during his absence, he uses them to make blocks and builds a doll's house for his daughter under the initially skeptical eye of two tradesmen who are doing some repairs. When one of the tradesmen tries to crush a block between his hands and fails, he seems to glimpse the possibilities. And the other one remarks, and you can get this paper anywhere. The refuge labyrinth built of paper clearly allegorizes the archive, whose labyrinthine nature has been mentioned repeatedly. But it also seems to stand for Human Material, a book that recycles the waste paper of a failed investigation, giving it durable form. Before Ray Rosa uses the word labyrinth, he tells us that on his first day at La Isla, an archivist named Ariadna Sandoval suggested that the founder of the Identification Bureau, Benedicto Tun, might serve as a guiding thread for his investigation. I don't think the name Ariadne, refers, but it surely signifies. This character makes no further appearances. Her function, it seems, is simply to provide the thread, which, as in the myth of Theseus and the Minotaur, recounted by Plutarch and Apollodorus, guides the quester out of the labyrinth, in this case to Benedicto Tun Jr. The crucial difference between the myth and Human Material is that Ray Rosa never confronts the Minotaur, whom he nevertheless identifies as Roberto Lemus, the possible kidnapper. I quote, "So he was the Minotaur who was waiting for me in the depths of the archive, the sort of Minotaur you get in a labyrinth like that. He's probably as scared of me as I am of him. If I attacked him, I wonder, would he defend himself?" Given Ray Rosa's devotion to Borges, evidenced in Human Material by his numerous quotations from Adolfo Bioy Casares' enormous book of table talk, Borges, and the fact that labyrinths are a signature motif in the work of the Argentine author, the last words of the passage I quoted resonate persuasively with the end of The House of Asterion. The Minotaur scarcely defended itself. Ray Rosa's footnote to the mythical story does not have a hero or a redeemer, which is how Asterion imagines Theseus in Borges' story. But I would argue that Human Material as a whole does have a hero, the man known simply as the Chief, El Jefe, who is real but portrayed in a way that is characteristic of fiction. We can see this by comparing Ray Rosa's portrait with the way in which Kirsten Weld describes the same man, Gustavo Meoño, in Paper Cadavers. At the first mention of Meoño, she provides a physical snapshot, a strapping avuncular man in his early 60s, and a curriculum vitae, so that we know from the outset where he comes from and what he stands for. Ray Rosa, by contrast, reveals character slowly through action, as novelists do with the characters that E.M. Forster called round. "The test of a round character," said Forster, "is whether it is capable of surprising in a convincing way. If it never surprises, it is flat. If it does not convince, it is a flat pretending to be round." In the first part of the book, the Chief is affable but elusive and comes increasingly to seem evasive. Then an acquaintance tells Ray Rosa that he is El Comandante Paolo, one of the leaders of the ERP, the Revolutionary Army of the Poor, and that he was a member of a tribunal that condemned to death a number of guerrilla fighters thought to have betrayed that organization, including a group of women captured in Guatemala who, after escaping, or being allowed to escape, went into exile in Nicaragua, where they made contact with former comrades, breaking a rule among the insurgents. In the light of this revelation, it begins to look as if the Chief's elusiveness might be motivated by having something to hide. When Ray Rosa finally is able to meet the Chief again, he asks him about his past in the ERP and the executions. The Chief is not evasive for a moment in responding to these questions. Yes, he was one of the founders of the ERP, and yes, he did agree to the executions, and none of this is a secret. He testified before the Commission for Historical Clarification in 1996 and asked that his real name be recorded, but that was contrary to the Commission's protocol. He also regrets some of the decisions made during the conflict, either because they were based on erroneous information or because, in retrospect, he feels that they were excessively harsh. When the ERP's other leaders were content to let the children of the executed go on thinking that they had died in action, he took it on himself to tell them what had happened. And I quote, this is Meoño speaking in the book, "There are some who, even after finding out that we executed their parents, have not renounced the revolutionary spirit. And it's strange, but on the other hand, there are many who would have preferred never to know the truth." This is a man who demonstrates what Foucault in his last seminar series called the courage of truth. That is, the frankness, the Socratic parresia of the person who accepts the risk not simply of upsetting his or her interlocutor, but of provoking a series of acts that can go as far as the most extreme violence, as Foucault said. In this case, the Chief, already a dangerous subversive in the eyes of the military, has exposed himself to potential threats from the orphans who might seek vengeance, and from the other leaders of the ERP who might want to shut him up. The courage of truth, as Foucault pointed out, is not just a matter of being frankly critical of others. It also involves making difficult admissions. The difficulty of admitting that the executions were errors, if not atrocities, is something that the chief has not overcome once and for all, but must live with. For him, it is a matter of life and death, in a literal, not a figurative sense. This parresia shines all the more brightly by contrast with the attitude and behaviour of the flat character Javier Mejía, the acquaintance who attempted to poison Ray Rosa's mind against the chief. Mejía is a writer who could be interesting, thinks Ray Rosa, if he could just stop indulging in that strange and inexplicable self-satisfaction. He too was once a member of the ERP and seems to bear a personal grudge against the chief. Since the end of the conflict, he has been a cultural attaché in Washington and now works for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He has become that familiar figure in Latin American letters, the semi-official diplomat author, careful never to offend the wielders of institutional power. He compares the executions within the RP to the crimes committed by the Guatemalan military. "I don't see the symmetry," says Ray Rosa in response. Indeed, there's a clear quantitative imbalance. Estimates vary, but not very much. According to the Commission for Historical Clarification, the guerrilla organizations were responsible for 3% of the human rights violations during the conflict. But the asymmetry is qualitative as well. There is an important moral difference between sentencing combatants to death for treason and wiping out civilian villages, not to mention torture and rape. When Mejía says of the chief, "he's a killer too," he is not only using a misleading form of words. The chief was a political cadre, not a combatant, and the name El Comandante Paulo was one given to him by the military. He's also engaging in a rhetorical ploy that aims to foreclose the process of truth recovery by implying that all hands are equally dirty. If the chief finds his opposite number in the self-satisfied Mejía, he also has a paradoxical ally, Benedicto Tun, who set up the Identification Bureau in 1922 and ran it until 1970 under successive governments, mostly dictatorial, but also during the Revolutionary Spring from 1944 to 1954. Ray Rosa is surprised by this professional survival and wonders whether it was achieved by self-serving opportunism or whether Tun could have been a decent man, at least in the Orwellian sense, by which he means, can he have been endowed with that common decency that George Orwell repeatedly praised and associated in The Road to Wigan Pier with the socialism of the genuine working man, as opposed to the book-trained socialist higher up. While this question, like many others in human material, is left open, Tun, like the chief, is a round character who surprises convincingly. The fictive name Tun resembles the matronym of Rigoberto Menchú Tum, and like the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, Benedicto Tun, or the real model for him, belonged to the Quiché Maya ethnic group. He moved from San Cristóbal Totonicapán to the capital to study law, but soon after found a job on the staff of President Manuel Estrada Cabrera. After Estrada's fall in 1922, he established the Identification Bureau and became a pioneer of forensic science in Guatemala. When he found that Mario Méndez Montenegro, a presidential candidate and former police chief, had committed suicide, he was instructed to change this finding to one of homicide, which would have been expedient for Méndez's party and especially for his brother, who later became president. Tun refused to change his report and would have been jailed for this defiance had he not been extracted from the police barracks by a bold intervention on the part of his son. The following day, he submitted his resignation, which was not accepted by the president. Tun's son says, "there were people who spoke ill of him, of course, because they were affected by his reports or considered him part of the apparatus of repression or out of prejudice," and I think he means racial prejudice there. Was he part of the apparatus of repression? Well, he didn't heroically oppose the often criminal governments under which he worked, but in his domain of specialisation, forensic evidence, he seems to have been incorruptible. Ray Rosa suspects that he is the author of a text in praise of Fouché, which he finds in the Bureau's report for 1939. But unlike Joseph Fouché, Napoleon's police minister, Tun did not destroy the records that he had accumulated and organised. If his work facilitated the exercise of political repression, it is also now facilitating the project's attempts to recover the truth about the crimes committed by the army and the military, as shown by the 2013 report From Silence to Memory, Revelations of the AHPN. So there is a surprising objective alliance between the ex-guerrilla fighter and now activist Meoniu and the career bureaucrat Benedicto Tun. Meanwhile, what eventually develops between Reyrosa and the chief is a solidarity that could not have been achieved without the taking of a risk. Kirsten Weld has explained how the project's delicate work necessitated recruitment on the basis of confianza, and I'm quoting Weld now. In this setting, confianza's literal translation as trust was a thin description. Its deeper connotation was a certain level of dedication to human rights work and memory politics, not easily quantified. Confianza, explained by the project's assistant director, was not easily quantified, but it essentially meant that the people who referred to us, but that people are referred to us by people or organizations that we trust, that we know their trajectory, their level of commitment, that they've been linked to the causes that are worth fighting for in this country. The chief makes an exception for Reyrosa, who doesn't come with these credentials, largely because he was out of the country between 1979 and 1994, and to whom he accords a special privilege. The decision was, he says, based on an intuition, and I may have made a mistake because I don't know you, nor are we friends. At this point, the chief's doubt about the soundness of his decision is matched by Reyrosa's suspicion that he's being used. This is how he interprets the chief's intuition, that the project of my work as a writer, the product of my work as a writer, could bring the project for the recovery of the archive to the notice of a non-specialist public and convince people of the importance of such a discovery. This interpretation is probably accurate, if uncharitably incomplete. Accurate because publicising the project, which is which has always relied on fixed-term international funding, is an important part of the chief's work. And Reyrosa is one of the few Guatemalan novelists with an international profile. But the interpretation is also incomplete because in order for the chief to take this gamble, he had to feel that the special privilege would not be abused. The other part of his intuition was that Reyrosa was a trustworthy person. This episode's right in the middle of the narrative, and the moderate degree of mutual suspicion still evident here indicates how gradually the trust between the two men builds. The slow development of this relationship is shown, rather than told, in a novelistic way, by strategically withholding crucial information and using uncertainty about motives as a source of narrative tension. By the end of the book, however, it's clear that the chief and Reyrosa have entered into what the philosopher Honora O'Neill, speaking in Belfast in 2002, termed a virtuous spiral of trust. Reyrosa promises to show the chief the manuscript of his book and not to publish it without his consent. The chief says that he is happy for his real name to be used. Although that name is easy to find and I've been mentioning it, Reyrosa declines to use it, perhaps because by this point in the narrative, it's clear that the moniker, the chief, is more than an administrative title. It is a fully appropriate, if not proper name, well and truly earned. This consolidation of a bond is not necessarily symptomatic of broader change, but at the interpersonal level, it does show how a community of trust can be extended beyond a natural affinity group in a necessarily tentative way. By engaging the reader imaginatively, managing narrative tension, employing the figure of allegory, setting up intertextual resonances, gradually revealing character through action, and counterposing round and flat characters, human material does, in fact, novelise the archive and the project. Its claim to have failed in that attempt is either excessively modest or a way of signalling that the author has renounced a standard feature of fiction, that of including, in Stacey Friend's words, invented elements such as descriptions of what has never happened, contenting himself instead with selection, arrangement, and some renaming, as he indicates right at the end of the book. The renunciation of invented elements may not be absolute. Giving a name like Ariadna Sandoval is already a significant kind of invention. But still, I think it marks human material as the homage of a vocational fabulist to those who have committed their lives to truth recovery, in spite of the forbidding resistance and inertia they must battle every day, not to speak of personal risk. People like Gustavo Meoniu, the chief of the project, and all of his staff, or like the ex-Attorney General of Guatemala, Claudia Paz y Paz, who in her sadly shortened term of office from 2010 to 2014 made an inspiring dent in the nation's culture of impunity.